they must be clear about their raison d'etre. That institutional identity that I spoke of earlier. What good is the freedom if I don't know what I am free to defend? They must then be clear about their reason for existence and not be deterred by pragmatic reasons from insisting on this administrative liberty. It is the foundation of all else. If only individual freedom were defended as against the institutional, no organized body in the country could long remain safe, and we would soon see the end of any society that individuals decided was not to their taste. Academic freedom. Academic freedom for teachers is among the most highly treasured assets of the teaching profession. The right to explore and communicate their ideas in the classroom and in writing without being subject to interference or penalization because these ideas are unacceptable to someone within or beyond the institution. My conviction, born of years of teaching experience, both in Catholic schools and in state institutions, is that the academic freedom enjoyed by teachers in church-related schools is far and above anything not only practiced, but even possible in secular and especially tax-supported institutions of learning. Let me first state the obvious. A teacher in a Catholic school does not have the moral right to oppose and directly contradict the basic philosophy of education on which the institution is built. No more than a man working for the State Department has a right to subvert the American government. But beyond this evident limitation, to dissent publicly and overtly and to the detriment of his students, he has all the freedom in the world to assent to the whole gamut of faith and idealism that is his and which is contrary to a secular institution does not enjoy. Where the atmosphere is congenial to belief and religious conviction, a teacher is free to communicate all of himself and not fear criticism or reprisal because he ventures beyond the limits of a studied neutralism which in practice becomes oppressive agnosticism pervading a school that on principle eschews religious orientation. Individual freedom. The individual freedom of the student to learn what he wants and needs is the least advertised liberty that Catholic schools afford. And yet it will soon become the crucial liberty as state monopoly of education grows apace. This is the freedom to learn. And it touches on the heart of education. It means the option of a student or his parents to decide in which school and under what teachers he wants to pursue his education. The recent position statements by the National Education Association, to which I referred in my previous lecture, correctly pointed out that schools on every level, whether tax-supported or not, cannot escape teaching religion. I will quote at some length from this policy statement of the NEA. Religion in this sense is defined as that which is one's ultimate concern, to use Paul Tillich's phrase, or according to Eric Fromm, that which is one's life's orientation. The teaching of a religious attitude from this standpoint is inescapable in any school. There is no teacher, no school, which can escape the problem of life orientation, and culture must be taken into account. It must, in other words, consider whether explicitly or implicitly those fundamental commitments which underlie every human action. Democracy, communism, and the various economic systems cannot be analyzed in their profoundest dimensions without getting into the questions of ultimate values. This is finally a religious question. Thus, we teach religion in the schools, whether we would or not. It would be better if the teaching of ultimate commitments were done intelligently rather than blindly. Unquote. The National Educational Association. Such frankness is refreshing, but it is also terrifying in its implications. If no school can avoid teaching a life orientation, it is supremely important that youth and their parents have the freedom to choose where this life orientation is received, and have competent educators available to respond to the philosophy of life they prefer. The alternative is to surrender to educational monopoly by the state. It is the privilege of Catholic schools to answer to these desires and to satisfy what young people most need. A value-centered education that gives intellectual unity to their thinking and purpose and direction to their studies. How does a Catholic school give this kind of purpose and direction? It does so by the words and example of those who administer and teach, men and women of dedication, who with all their limitations look upon their profession as a vocation, and whose own spiritual vigor strengthens the souls of those under their care. Education is a misnomer unless it means the transmission of ideals from person to person and of ideas from mind to mind. Education, in the last analysis, is the communion of spirit with spirit. Everything else is minor and secondary. The Catholic school satisfies these needs by everything the school, if it is Catholic, stands for. If it is true to the purpose of its being, it creates for the student a climate animated by the gospel spirit of freedom and charity to help young people grow in the new life they acquired at baptism while preparing them for the contemporary world to advance in the good things of the earthly city. It leads them for service in the cause of the kingdom of God. What, if any, do you think are the contributions of contemporary theology? I think there are many contributions of contemporary theology, but I would add contemporary Catholic theology. Let me mention just three. There is, for example, a new understanding of the societal influences on a person from the moment he is born and affecting him all his life. Consequently, when we speak of having a sinful nature, and that's why I added contemporary Catholic theology, without letting go of the sinful nature, there is such a thing as inheriting a sinful personality by the society or from the society that gave me birth and into which I am entering. So the sinfulness, not only of our nature, but of the pressures on our individual personality, have greatly sharpened the theology of sin. Another insight. This especially in the moral order. Without for a moment undercutting the objectivity of our moral acts. That an act is good when what I do is good, why I do it is good, and the circumstances in which I do it are good. If any of those three is bad, my action is bad. Modern theology has learned a great deal from the psychological sciences about the elements that affect responsibility. Therefore, culpability. And regarding sin, therefore, that it's quite possible for a person to commit an objectively grave sin and yet not be subjectively as responsible as perhaps some moralist thought before. A third insight regarding the nature of God. If there is one thing that describes our modern age, it is its social consciousness. We always knew, of course, that God is a trinity of persons. But we didn't used to speak in the terms we're using now that God is a society. That God, by a definition of His being, is social by nature. That God cannot be one person. If you will, God must have company. There wouldn't be a God unless there were a plurality of persons. There must be within God others. The word other has never had deeper meaning than today. For each person of the Trinity completely shares the fullness of his divine nature with the other two. And therefore, John's definition of God as love is not only that God is lovable towards us, but there wouldn't be a God unless within the Trinity there were others with whom each person could fully share what he mysteriously possesses as the fullness of the divine nature. And that consequently, Christ's words at the Last Supper, that they may be one as Thou, Father, in me, and I in Thee are one, has a depth of meaning that only in recent years has our socially conscious world begun to better understand. I'll stop with three insights. Could you give me a good summarized definition of the term grace? Yes, I can. Not so much a definition as an analytic description. The best way, I think, to understand what grace is to see it as the opposite of nature. What is nature? Speaking theologically, it comes, of course, from the Latin word natus, or the plural nati, born. One who is born. Nature is that with which and into which we are nati, born. And that's plenty. It's all that we have as individuals and all that human society offers us collectively through a lifetime of living among human beings. All of that is nature. What is grace? Grace is all that we need beyond nature to reach our heavenly destiny. Now, we evidently need nature too. But all that we need beyond what we are born into and with is grace. Consequently, we can synonymize this by saying that nature is that which is the given with which we come into the world. Grace is the lack. It can be further synonymized by saying that nature is that which we possess by just being human beings. Grace is that which we must acquire in order to be saved. And It is on this level that Christ, Christianity, and the church have all the meaning they have. Because faith tells us it is Christ and His church that are uniquely the media, the mediators, the channels, the means for acquiring that which we lack, which is grace, over and above what we are born with, or into, or the given, or possess, but without which, that is, this which we need to acquire, we could not reach our destiny with God. I would like to ask if the laws of fasting prior to the reception of the sacrament of Holy Eucharist have been changed recently. It seems a high school is, in close proximity, is supposed to have said that something may be eaten up until the time of celebrating the Eucharist. Well, given some celebrations of the Eucharist that I hear about, I can well imagine what they might be eating. The answer is no. The laws on fasts before receiving the Eucharist remain in effect. 1 hour, as you know, from food and drink, except water which may be taken up to communion time, and also anything which is authentically medicinal. I would like to ask you if you have had an opportunity to read an article in the October 72 issue of Sisters Today entitled Confession, Communal and Individual. I'm sorry that I did not happen to see the issue. In fact, having seen quite a few issues of Sisters Today, I've decided I have more profitable ways of spending my reading time. Beyond that comment, I'm not in a position to reply to this specific question. Please justify your statement of November the 6th, 1972, in which you judged your priestly colleagues who study contemporary theology as being spiritually inept. Well, this, of course, is the difference between what a person says and what people think he said. I didn't say that because I cannot say that, if for no other reason than because I am deeply involved in studying contemporary theology. And at least for selfish reasons, I don't consider myself spiritually inept. But perhaps behind the question is the need for the distinction I made earlier. Not all contemporary theology is Catholic. And having published 5 books outside of Catholicism, I know something about the non-Catholic, non-Christian world. In order to study contemporary theology, which is not Catholic, a person must be, first of all, intellectually equipped. and the ability to read words or look them up in the dictionary is no guarantee of understanding what a person reads. But secondly, in order to profit, and a person can profit immensely from non-Catholic, non-Christian, anti-Catholic. In fact, in my small room at Hyde Park at the University of Chicago, the largest book on the small shelf that I have next to my bed, away from my office, is the autobiography of Bertrand Russell, who by no stretch of the imagination was either a Catholic or a Christian, but I might add, and perhaps for the benefit of the questioner, having gone through the experience myself, to profit from the challenge which men of the caliber of Russell offer the believing mind, one must, and the verb is must, try to live as close as possible to God. If he doesn't, what he began by reading sympathetically, he will end by believing sincerely. This is a similar statement. Please justify by documenting reputable sources. Your statement, November 6, 1972, in which you passed judgment in blanket fashion upon many of your priestly fellow students of theology as being spiritually inept. My answer to this question is the same as the previous one. I am too painfully involved in theology not to know what is happening. Too many of my fellow classmates, my former students, ordained priests, have left the Society of Jesus, the priesthood, and not a few, all semblance of Christian faith, not to know that mere exposure to contemporary theology is no protection against what can be a devastating experience. Hence, the great importance of being spiritually strong. The mind alone will not do it.
This tape was produced by Select Religious Recordings. All rights are reserved. Duplication or transcription in any form is strictly prohibited.